Hey, welcome to VoiceOver.
I'm your host, Heather Bigley. I talk with people about the movies that made a mark, taught them something important, showed them a new way of being in relationship, created a space for self-reflection, touched them emotionally and spiritually. And it's not always the movie you'd expect. With today's guest, I'm going to talk about Arrival from 2016, directed by Denis Villeneuve. The script is adapted from a Ted Chiang short story called Story of Your Life. And it stars Amy Adams as a linguist, Louise Banks, who is asked by the American Army to help decode the language of extraterrestrials who are now hovering over Earth in their spaceships. She works with this physicist named Ian Donnelly, played by Jeremy Renner, and they develop this usable vocabulary to communicate with aliens, who they've begun to call heptapods. As she works longer and longer in their language, her memory begins to work in a really different way. And she's either having flashbacks or it's flash forwards about her daughter and marriage. It's very unclear what's happening until the very end of the film. So, this movie was a huge success. I assume you've seen it, unless you're much younger than me and then maybe you were a toddler. But I assume you've seen it and you probably know the end and you probably know what's going to happen. We'll be talking about all kinds of plot points in this discussion, so if you haven't seen it and you're nervous about spoilers, know that we will be discussing the film's most important reveal. And now, our guest, Ian Puente. Hey, make sure to stick around after the conversation for a few recommendations of other films you might like. I'm here with Ian Puente. Ian, welcome.
Thank you. Hopefully you can make me look smart.
That's the one thing I can do in editing is I have people talk to me about, oh, thank you for editing me that way because I sounded like I knew what I was talking about.
You just play me at 1.25 speed and remove all the ums.
Yes.
That would be great.
Okay. So we're here tonight to talk about Arrival. And Arrival is this really fascinating film for me because I did not go into it expecting to have any kind of spiritual experience. Right? It's a sci-fi movie. It's Denis Villeneuve, right? He's awesome, but he's done scary stuff. And so as I'm sitting there and I'm watching Arrival and having an incredibly spiritual experience, this idea or this question came to me, which is this a place where I'm supposed to have a spiritual experience? Like in a movie theater? Is that what films can do? Should they do that? And we're coming out of a particular religious tradition that does use film didactically in some places.
Yeah, unfortunately, not as successfully as other places have used them. But
right. But also we use film in a religious experience.
In education and all of those things. No, absolutely. I mean, look, I don't think I would have pursued a film degree if I hadn't had a number of meaningful spiritual experiences with it. I don't think you can really have an argument with anybody that well, I'm sure some heartless folks have never shed a tear in a movie or felt emotion. They're built to have you feel those things.
Right.
But
emotion and spirituality are not necessarily.
That's exactly what I was going to say, which is, you know, figuring out how to parse what is just an emotional reaction to swelling music or a particularly powerful performance versus a true kind of communion with God, for lack of a more elegant way of saying that.
That's a pretty good way to say it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I try.
Well, communion with God, communion with those around you, often spiritual experiences are about, right, a community where together you commit yourself to some goal, or maybe goal sounds too American 20th century, but you commit yourself to a course of action that will bring you closer to God or bring you right into a higher order. Zion, we call it.
That's right. Well, I mean, even as what's interesting is even as a practicing member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I find them, at least historically, when you would go to a theater, not that a lot of people do that as much anymore.
Right.
To me, it was almost like a going to, I hate to use the term at worship service,
right.
But you know, it's one of those situations where you're sitting with a group of people, you're having kind of a communal experience on one level, but you're it's your own very intimate personal experience at the same time,
right?
And I feel that way about religion, right? I go to organized religion and church because I like the support and the community, but most of my own spiritual pursuit is more of an individual effort,
right?
Or lack of effort, depending on the point in time in my life. But
and what's really fascinating about that is you can be sitting in the same church service or movie and people are getting completely different things out of it.
Yeah. Right? That's what's great about it.
Yeah.
That's
or
really
awful.
Fun.
Or
well, it's I mean, it shows you the limitations of human experience and
right.
a human connection and
right.
but it also shows you the opportunity. It's pretty fun.
Yeah. I also heard someone say the other day, a text does not interpret itself. So everybody brings with them mm-hmm. whatever they have, and then they start, you know.
Well, isn't that a perfect segue
processing.
Into Arrival about language
yeah.
and how it
oh my gosh.
How it colors our viewpoint on the world?
Yeah. So this is based on, right, a short story. And I have to say, adapting short stories is so much smarter than adapting novels.
Like, oh, golly. Yeah.
Right? Shorter. They cover smaller time periods. There's less characters. Like, so Ted Chiang writes a short story, and it's quite good on its own. But I have to say that the film makes certain changes that I thought really brought out the ideas much, much more, much stronger, strongerly. is that a word? I don't know. I just really like the visuals of the language themselves because it's a visual medium.
Right.
Like, this kind of thing is just... It's just better done in a way. Yeah, but this whole point of how the language you learn teaches you how to interpret the world. And if you learn other languages, you will learn other ways to interpret the world, which I think we both have had an experience with, right? You speak other languages.
Poorly. I served a mission in Sweden.
Yeah. Did you ever dream?
In Swedish?
In Swedish?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Not
yeah.
for a very long time now. But,
no, haven't done it for
yeah.
decades.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of thriving Swedish-speaking communities in California or Utah.
Or Utah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, did you ever have a heptapod show up in your dreams?
No.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing when in this film, when he says, "Are you dreaming about them?" and they show up, I was like, "That's the scariest thing."
That was the scariest moment in the show.
Like, I would have woken up and the bed would have been wet because if that had been my dream.
As I'm getting older, that's happening more and more with unprovoked.
Yes, unprovoked.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, the film to me, Denis, we're on a first name basis because we're very close friends.
And also his name's harder to pronounce than his first name.
Villeneuve.
Yeah. Nice. Nicely done.
He's Quebecois, right? He's
yeah.
from Montreal.
I like to say they speak trucker French there.
Oh, my gosh. It's totally unintelligible. no offense, Denis. I know you'll be listening to this later.
Yeah.
I feel like all of his films have a fairly significant spiritual component to them. You know, Prisoners.
Oh, my gosh. That's a hard movie to watch.
It's a really unpleasant film to watch, but it's very much about a relationship with God and, you know, the pros of that and the pretty dark cons of it when you set yourself up in opposition to him
right.
in a way. Even his first film, which I can't remember the name of and I wouldn't necessarily recommend, but it's very much about, it's a redemption story.
Right.
And I mean, admittedly, Dune is a little more complex, and certainly I would say he has a complicated relationship with faith and spirituality. But yeah, it didn't surprise me, and it felt like there was a lot of things in there. I mean, even down to the aliens, they looked like the hand of God to me, right?
Yes.
Like. There
right.
was so much there.
There's the number 7.
Right. Well, and also, you know, even like the way that they interacted with him, that it was through a glass darkly, right? Like
oh,
you're interacting
nice.
With the higher power and
yeah.
and you're having a hard time interpreting what's coming to you. And a lot of that is a very spiritual kind of pursuit where you don't know what is the voice of God, what is real, and
right.
what am I just inserting my own thoughts into. Like I felt like the alien ship, it was more like a mountain, like it was stone.
And at around 8 hours after landing, there's still no signs of what might be called first contact. Yeah, now the objects measure at least 1,500 feet tall.
Two are reported to have penetrated.
You notice that? Like, it was they ascended to the mountain to speak with God. And
nice. I thought of it as an egg shaped, sort of like a concave egg.
That's fair. Yeah. That's fair.
And the whole idea of time being circular, like basically all present. All things are present in the mind of God.
Yeah.
Right. You're pointing out things that I didn't really think of. Like, I had such an emotional experience at the end of that film. Mm-hmm. Because to me, it was this, a secular manifestation of an understanding of joy. Right. In Revelations, we get this wonderful verse. I think it's Revelations 21. The Revelation. Sorry. All my evangelical students will be upset. The Revelation where, you know, it says all things are known to God and he's going to wipe away all the tears. But it doesn't mean there won't be tears.
Right.
It just means here's your father who comes to comfort you and say it was worth it to some degree.
Yeah.
Right. And here is this movie where she makes this choice, a choice that angers her husband, right? And we're supposed to understand that the divorce is...
That's ultimately precipitates the separation and divorce,
that
right?
Largely, he's decided, I can't live with that kind of pain, and I'm going to leave.
Well, that creates a whole other ethical conversation that never gets touched on in that movie, which is she made a choice knowing what the end result was going to be, but she allowed him to partake in that choice without knowing what the end result was going to be.
Oh, wow. This sounds familiar.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me because, you know, we believe pretty strongly in this notion of a pre-mortal existence, that we kind of all came together with our Heavenly Father, with God, and made a decision to come to Earth. Now, there's different interpretations of what that decision entailed. But I feel pretty strongly that we had a strong sense of the pain and the difficulty we were going to be asked to undertake as part of this development, educational growth process. And so that really resonated with me when she decided, oh, this is going to really suck, but there's going to also be moments of great joy.
Yeah.
And so I'm willing to take the good with the bad.
If you could see your whole life from start to finish, would you change things?
I mean, for me, that's the understanding of joy. I think a lot of us have this idea that happiness is when I would say happiness is a shallower understanding of joy.
Sure.
There's nothing wrong. Every night I get a full night's sleep and I, you know, eat good food and there's no stress, right? And to me, this said, no, you can't have joy. You can't have this deep experience of what it means to be alive if you don't accept that there are going to be horribly painful moments, right?
Sure. No, I completely agree with that. I think, I mean, look, I still, even pushing 50, rebel against that, just sort of at an emotional level.
Well, I mean, no one should seek out.
Not that I say it's wrong. I mean, it's right. It's just, it's the natural inclination to look at suffering and difficulty as a defect or a flaw of this existence. But in reality, it's a feature of this existence. It is part of the point of this existence.
And I would say that I'm a firm believer in not seeking out, you know, pain and, you know, if you...
Oh, I dig it. I go after it all the time.
Well, you have 5 children.
Yes, I undertook a lot more pain than I had initially intended.
But in my mind, like, there's living... Yeah, anyway, I'm not one who seeks things out and says, oh, that's... But I would say to you, like, when you said we kind of knew that everything would... We knew the extent of the pain. I was like, we may have known it, but I'm thinking like right before I made big decisions like marriage or like, you know, I'm also a Latter-day Saint. Before I served my mission, I was like, oh, yeah, people say this is really hard.
Yeah.
And then I got into the mission field and was like, I felt hit upside the head with how hard it really was. And so I had this intellectual knowledge, but I didn't have the experience.
It's a totally fair way of looking at it. Yes, I do think you can't know until you know, until you go through it. But we were not, I don't think we were unaware, or there was a lack of disclosure about the things that were coming.
There was transparency.
There just was also, but there was a lack of understanding of what that would actually entail and how difficult that would be.
Right.
I just meant that, you know, yes, intellectually we knew, right? We made an informed decision, even though we may regret that decision at times now that we're here.
Yeah.
And I know I've done that, so.
Well, I remember teaching a Sunday school class, and there was a man, and this was in Houston, Texas. There was a man in the class who had recently joined the church, and he and his wife had struggled with drug addiction for a really long time. And we were going through Adam and Eve. And, you know, everyone in the class was saying these wise things about, like, oh, yeah, well, we had to leave the garden because we had to learn, because, you know, we had to go through all these things. And he raised his hand and in all sincerity was like, I don't know if it was worth it. Like, I would so much have rather stayed in the garden because the drug addiction that I have been through and I still struggle with is so overwhelming. And so in some ways, I guess I'm saying that for the Ian character in the movie, right, who says, never mind, I don't want any part of this, or I can't handle it. In some ways, I can understand why he might have made that decision.
Oh, for sure.
Even though her decision is, you know, sort of amazing.
She was able to, I mean, at least the way it was portrayed, she was able to understand the totality of the experience, right?
Right.
It's a big difference between how our experience, how I believe our experience goes forward, because there's no way to know it all right at that moment and to have experienced it all at once. But it is a brave thing to still go through that experience.
Believe it or not, I know something that's going to happen. I can't explain how I know, I just do. And when I told your daddy, he got really mad. And he said I made the wrong choice.
And I spent a bit of time after watching the movie thinking, would I have had the kid?
Right.
If I knew it was going to be like this?
Yeah. Well, and there are other people. I've read reviews where people think she made an unethical decision. Like, if you know a child is going to die of, you know, a disease, is it fair to have a child? Right? Like, they didn't get to make that decision. You're making the decision for them. What do you think about that?
Again, people make decisions for each other all the time.
Right.
If people making decisions for you and sometimes bad decisions on your behalf was a reason to never exist, I think I'd probably take the bad decisions of others. And I don't know. I mean, we never really get into the girl.
Yeah.
We don't know her. You catch glimpses that she's angry at times, obviously, and you catch glimpses that she's joyful at times, just like any of us. And it really does beg the question, how long is enough life?
Right? No, yeah, and I think because the girl is, you know, a teenager at the time, I think the filmmakers themselves were trying to mitigate that. Even though in the short story, she's like in her 20s.
When she dies?
When she dies, and she dies from falling. She doesn't die from a disease. She's like a rock climber and she falls. So it's an interesting choice that the filmmakers made. Like, oh, let's...
Yeah, it is. It's much more complicated.
Yeah. Let's give her a disease. Let's make her younger. Let's... there's all this pathos.
Well, what was fascinating to me is they don't really spend any energy on it. She just, yeah, let's do this thing.
Right.
Like it doesn't, I don't feel any hesitation. It's just,
yeah,
we're going.
Yeah.
I don't know why they wouldn't spend a little more energy to show that it is a hard decision she's making.
I felt though, because this was the third or fourth time I watched it, it's one of those films when you rewatch it, right, and now you have all of the information, you reinterpret the acting.
Got it.
So when I was watching it again this time, those opening, when she's sort of reacting to the child, she's now, there seems to be much more weight and much more pain in the memories that she's having. So it's not just like, there's this one scene where she has the baby and then she kind of puts her head down and you're like, oh, she has this new baby, she must be tired.
Sure.
Come back to me. Come back to me.
And how it plays with our expectations. But this time watching it, I was like, oh, she has a new baby. And now for a moment, she thinks, how long will I have this child?
Right. Right.
Or this is so limited. And have I made the right decision? So I was reevaluating the performance based on that knowledge. But the first time through, I just thought, oh, she had the baby in the past. Right. And I think that was what's most interesting to me about the film is the chronology and the nonlinearity.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're essentially letting you see the world through the eyes of the aliens.
Right.
Right. And yeah, that would be, it's a very interesting way to see things where everything's sort of present before right. you all at the same time. I don't know how I'd make decisions. I can't, you know, it's very hard to put yourself in that sort of a space, I suppose, right?
Right. But I mean, that's, I think we've said earlier, like the heptapods are sort of seeing us in the way that, or seeing time in the way that God sees it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it suddenly gives me some compassion for God that I never had before.
Sure, sure.
Which is how, I mean, we're all down here saying, God, why did you let this happen?
Right.
And I'm not a believer in, everything happens for a reason and God's got it all figured out. And if you just trust in him, I'm a believer.
No, it's messy. I think he makes the best of the mess, but
right.
you know, free agency. Once we have that, that ability to choose for ourselves.
Yeah, the reason
all bets are off.
Reason things happen is because people made really bad mm-hmm. decisions.
Yep.
And they're greedy and selfish. And
yeah,
yeah. So for me, it was, you know, thinking about it now, I just feel like, oh, God has to. He's kind of putting out fires, a lot of fires all over the place.
Yeah.
And sometimes saying, well, I'm going to let that fire burn.
Yeah. Well, it is one of those situations where he allows these things to happen. He has a much broader experience or broader viewpoint than we do. I mean, yeah. It's similar to the aliens, right? One, I forget, was it Abbott that was died
yes.
or in the explosion?
Abbott and, death process.
Yeah, death process.
Costello. Where's Abbott?
I don't think he's clinical like that or doesn't feel, but I think when you have that more broad sort of, if in my interpretation of God, right, which is there's neither a beginning nor an end, it all kind of continues, that some of the suffering we go through, while extremely meaningful to us, is probably, I don't want to use the word not meaningful to God, but feels similar to when, you know, a child falls and scrapes their knee as opposed to, you know, a
right.
existential crisis.
Right.
No, I mean, it's actually a very entertaining film. I didn't, it works on a number of levels. It's slow and it's methodical, but they let they let things build in a way that feels
yeah.
very real.
Well, it's like 30 minutes in before you meet the heptapods.
Right.
Right. Which I love. Like yeah. I'm the kind of person who let's just develop the world. I want to get to know this world, and how things work in it before we sort of, you know.
Right.
So I appreciated that. What did you have hesitations about the film?
No, my biggest takeaway was, how do I get that lake house?
Where is she? That's what I wanted to
yeah,
know.
Yeah, where is a place like that in commuting distance to a university and a big city center?
Right, but, and as a linguist, she has the money for it. That's all I
yeah,
thought.
Yeah, someone who pursued their PhD, you know better than I yes. do just how.
Like on the social sciences side, they're not raking in the dough. That's what I know.
She's a high-end linguist, I mean.
Okay, well, let's get started. Today we are talking about Portuguese and why it sounds so different from the other Romance languages. The story of Portuguese begins in the Kingdom of Galicia.
Big money, for sure.
Big money from the obviously the government's paying her lots of cash
That's
to
right.
work
That's
on
right.
their projects. Yeah, that lake house was beautiful.
It was really nice.
And, you know, sets the tone for the whole film. I mean, just the That's the other thing about this is everything's in grays, right? Kind of, you know.
Very muted colors.
Muted. And the music is minor key, kind mm-hmm. of Philip Glass kind of stuff. It's
yep.
really, really evocative and nothing like what you would think. Again, this is supposed to be a sci-fi film, right?
Well, and it's great in the sense that, you know, with that kind of approach, it's not a movie that's telling you how to feel. It's not a movie that is trying to make you have a spiritual experience or really just make a judgment one way or the other. Like you feel like everything feels very real.
Right.
It feels quite observational. It's not like it's not sensational in
yeah.
any way, right? And I like that about it in the sense that you're kind of, it feels like you're going through something like you're just another member of the group that's going through this process.
Right.
And it is much more of a character piece than a sci-fi movie.
Yeah. I mean, she's in this high stress situation and we see all the stress, right?
Yep.
I thought about that too. Like there's a lot of these kinds of films where, you know, someone would be really stoic and they mm-hmm. would go in and be like, I've got it all handled. And
right.
But she's like completely freaked out the whole time.
Yep.
And I just love the humanness of Amy Adams, right?
She's a great actress.
She's a great actress. She's also beautiful, but she's not, you know, here she's not costumed as glamorous. She just looks like a normal woman having this experience. And then, and for me, like, she's a redhead. I'm a redhead. But for me, I could be like, oh, right. Like, this is an identifiable person in a real, in an unreal situation.
And as a PhD and a redhead. You feel for Amy Adams.
Yep.
I mean, do. Jeremy Renner's also great.
Oh, yeah. In the girlfriend role, though, which I appreciated, too.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Yeah.
And then you've got it's a great
I
cast.
Love
Forrest
Whitaker.
Whitaker's great.
Golly. Way of the Samurai, we could talk about that as a spiritual
golly.
Film. I love that movie.
Even the tool that works for the CIA, I forget who that was, but he's a good character actor.
Yeah, he's great.
You hate him in everything. He does
a
great job of that.
We did our best, but it wasn't enough. Captain Willow Job, you're lifting off in 5 minutes.
That must be one of the suckiest things to be, is an actor that you just get roles where people think you're a jerk and an idiot. So,
who is that guy in Real Genius? And then he shows up in Ghostbusters. There's the 1980s version of that. Do you remember him? He's the EPA guy in Ghostbusters.
Yes, yes. He was also in Die Hard as jerk news guy that unveils that John McClane and Holly are married to each other.
All right.
And he gets punched by Holly at the end of the movie. It's fantastic. We're venturing
that's fine.
A little out.
Yep.
Out.
Because I love in Ghostbusters where the EPA has a lot of power.
So much power.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
Police, go shut that down. Okay, EPA bureaucrat, I will do that.
I'll do exactly as you say, sir. Yeah, if someone were going to say, I'm going to watch Arrival, would you say anything? Like, would you prepare them in any way? Or what would you say to them? What would be your, like, two-line?
See, the first time I watched it, someone had told me a little bit when I went to watch it, and I didn't appreciate that. So, no,
okay.
I wouldn't tell somebody.
Yeah.
I think it's valuable to kind of have that reveal.
Right. I usually
not because it's an M. Night Shyamalan twist ending.
Right.
It's very meaningful to understand, to see that when you're watching it for the first time, to think that she's got this backstory
right.
of of loss, and then to realize, no, this is coming for her and she's going to do it.
Yeah.
Right.
For me, to go back to that idea of emotion they were talking about before, for me, movies have always been the safe place where you can feel the emotion.
Sure.
Right? You're in the dark.
Yeah, you can cry a bit and everything's fine. Nobody's watching you.
Yeah. And yeah, it's not you going through it, right? So for whatever reason, you're just being sympathetic.
It's cathartic.
Yeah.
Right? To not have the suffering yourself.
Right. But maybe learn something at the same time. Well, thanks for coming in. Thanks for chatting about this movie with me. And
it was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Arrival is one of those films that broke me, but in a good way. I didn't say this to Ian, but after the movie in the theater parking lot, I sobbed for 10 minutes. My husband was very concerned, even more so because I couldn't properly articulate actual words about what I was feeling. I was so upset. I don't know even how to say what was I feeling? That's the question. This film was able to articulate something that I knew spiritually, even though it scared me, and that the point of life is not happy endings, but in learning and growing, and I hesitate to say it, loving. I'm not very good at that love part. It's hard. And here was this character who made an incredibly hard choice to love, even when she knew there would be anguish and pain. Because joy is not ease and comfort and glee. Joy is knowing what it costs to bring you to God and knowing that the cost was worth it. I saw that on the screen in Arrival when our main character chooses, even though she knows that her daughter will die, to have a daughter and chooses to marry her boyfriend, even though she knows he's going to leave her. So just really beautiful, poignant stuff. So how about some recommendations? I am going to recommend Interstellar here, and I'm not actually a Christopher Nolan fan, but I think Arrival and Interstellar offer these two perspectives on parenthood, what it means to create a family, and what it means to lose it, that are really helpful side by side. They're like bookends for each other. And in fact, for me, the most interesting parts of Interstellar are about the relationships between the fathers and their children. So you have the researcher, Michael Caine, and his daughter, played by Anne Hathaway. And then you have the pilot, who is played by Matthew McConaughey, and he has his younger children. Decades later, Jessica Chastain plays his daughter. And Anne Hathaway's monologue on love transcending time and space fits right into Arrival's examination of time and relationship and choice. The second film I want to recommend is Harold Ramis's 1993 Groundhog Day. This movie is brilliant. It remains one of my favorite films because it's hilarious. Obviously, but it's about choice and the strive for growth and, again, love. Bill Murray plays a TV weatherman trapped in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, reliving Groundhog Day again and again and again. Some people theorize perhaps for like millennia till he becomes a better person. If you've seen it before, definitely watch it again. You're going to learn something new for who you are at this moment in time. And if you're a youngster who's a Margaret Qualley fan, meet her mom, Andie MacDowell, in one of the best films of her career. My last recommendation is going to be In the Mood for Love, another rumination on love and choice and chance, but this time set in 1960s Hong Kong. It's from director Wong Kar-wai, and this film is an absolute jewel. It's about two people who are abandoned by their spouses and then fall in love with each other, should they or shouldn't they start a relationship. Even if their spouses have sort of broken that marital promise, does that mean that they can engage in that same kind of behavior? Go for the moral dilemmas and then stay for the costumes, the hair, the moody lighting, the soundtrack featuring Nat King Cole singing Quizás, Quizás, Quizás. It is fantastically produced and designed and written, and there's just so much to love about this film. Also, the beautiful Tony Leung Chiu-wai he stars in this film, and he also stars in Infernal Affairs, which was later adapted by Martin Scorsese into The Departed. VoiceOver is a production of BYU Radio and is edited by Soraya Pearson.